Okay, folks, welcome to Life on Planet Porky, okay? This is a brand new podcast in which myself, the Porkmeister, you know who I am, brings to you the facts of life as they are on Planet Porky, okay? Planet Porky is a place where you will find out what's going on in the real world, not the world in which we all live, okay? My observations, my investigations, my desire to get to the truth is always going to be there. And that's why this edition of Life on Planet Porky is called Seeking Truth and Justice. I've been known for many years as the seeker of truth and justice, okay? And I take pride in that because I want to bring to you the scandalous behaviour of some people in life and some of the things that are wrong with our world, which we can put right, but which some people don't want put right, because it's in their interest that it is not put right, okay? Now, I want to tell you about what happens at universities in this country, okay? Seeking truth and justice, of course. I feel it is my responsibility. And when I went to, I will admit for the first time ever, actually, that I didn't actually go to university. I went to Trent Polytechnic, okay? And that has since been named the University of the Trent. So I always claim that it was the University of the Trent when I was there, but it wasn't. It was Trent Polytechnic. But I feel that as it's my alma mater, I now must treat it with the respect it deserves, with its new title, which is, of course, University of the Trent, named after the river on which it's based, the River Trent, which, of course, was the river that Robin Hood walked across and jousted with Little John before he established his band of merry men in Sherwood Forest, which, of course, is there. Now, what I want to tell you about universities is this. When I was growing up, and it wasn't that long ago, by the way, folks, you know, don't believe all this nonsense about me. I'm in early middle age, and that's all you need to know. There weren't a lot of universities, and not a lot of youngsters went to university. I went to the King's School Chester, which I've told you about many times before, and that was, in fact, a production line for kids to go through their 11 plus through the entrance exam to the King's School and then onto university and to get a degree and then go out somewhere into business, okay? So what I'm saying is this. Ever since then, for instance, the Trent Polytechnic I went to a few years before I got there was the Nottingham Technical College, okay? Then it was upgraded to Trent Polytechnic. Now it's upgraded to university. So Nottingham's got two universities, like most cities in this country now, two universities. You know, like Brighton, you know, like London's got, you know, dozens of universities. But, you know, most, like Sheffield, like, I don't know, Newcastle, you know, used to be the Polytechnic, Newcastle Polytechnic and Newcastle University. It's now Newcastle University and the University of the Tyne, named after the river again. And we've got too many universities. Too many universities, too much money spent on them, too many kids coming out of universities with useless blinking degrees. Absolutely useless, you know. Can't get jobs now because, frankly, in my business now, in the communications business, at radio stations, TV stations, when you walk into these organisations, the person who greets you behind the desk that you first come to, very pleasant person, young person, male or female, it's a very menial job, isn't it? You know, just greeting people at the door and answering the phones. Usually they've got a degree because so many degrees are splashed out these days that they become meaningless. Now, I blame Tony Blair for this. I blame Tony Blair for a lot of things, like the Iraq War and, you know, all sorts of other things, because he's a guy who I felt was, you know, on the surface of it looked like, you know, he actually once said, you know, I'm a pretty straight sort of guy. I thought he was very insincere in some of the things he did. But that's another story for another day. What I'm saying is a good way for politicians to make it look as though employment figures are down and that young people are being looked after, is to just build loads of universities and send all these youngsters, usually aged 18, to universities and just get them to study for 3 years with bum degrees, OK? Now, in my day, that wasn't so bad because I came from a humble family, a great family, but a humble family, and I got a full grant for the 3 years. If I'd have stayed 3 years, I didn't. I only stayed 1 year because I realised it was no good to me. I needed to get out in the world. I was an entrepreneur already at the age of 18. I was a go-getter. I was a man who was going to get on in life and make strides, and I wasn't going to spend 3 years reading a load of daft books about urban estate management just to please somebody else and not me. I got into journalism and thus and therefore became incredibly successful, OK? So what I want to tell you about is one particular university where, due to, you know, this ridiculous campaign to make every child of 18 go to university, get a degree, therefore we must build thousands of universities to facilitate them. And by the way, I have some family down in Bournemouth. Every time I go down there, I see another huge building going up, right, on the edge of the city or around Bournemouth University campus. And by the way, Bournemouth University never used to be a university. It used to be a technical college. Then it became a polytechnic. Now it's a fully-fledged university, got a huge media faculty. And let me tell you this, you know, I work in the media. We don't need that many people coming out of Bournemouth University, let alone all the other universities that do it. And what you're doing is you're building up young people's hopes and knocking them down when they, you know, they end up literally. I mean, look, if they're determined, they want to do it, and some of them do, they become a runner at a TV station or something like that, and they get in life. But the competition is so severe because there's so many of them, and you've got to be really good and really determined to do it, like, of course, I was. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this, okay, is to get to the core of the story. And the core of the story is that I've come across one university and it's rated 67th in this country, okay, and it's called Leicester de Montfort University. It's de Montfort University in Leicester, and therefore that used to be a polytechnic as well, now became a university. But my gripe here, and remember you're listening to Seeker of Truth and Justice here, the Portmeister. My gripe here is that the guy who was basically running it, and the people who run universities are the vice-chancellors. The chancellor is often an honorary position, and the vice-chancellor is the guy who runs it on a day-to-day basis, okay? So, for instance, take a company, it has a chairman. Sometimes the chairman is chairman of other companies as well. Sometimes it's an executive chairman, so he's not there full-time. Guy who runs it is chief executive of the company. And the guy who runs universities is the vice-chancellor. Now, the reason I am focusing on this is that the vice-chancellor is a guy called Dominic Marcus Shellard. He's not there anymore. He's left. And the reason he's left is because information has emerged about the sheer waste of money it is having a university which is the 67th. It's ranked 67th. Least best university in this country, okay? And the guy who run it, this man Dominic Marcus Shellard, whose, you know, bizarre behaviour I'll tell you about in a minute, was earning something like 400 grand a year. In the last full financial year, I've got the figures here, Mr. Shellard, Dominic Marcus Shellard, right? Last financial year, was awarded the biggest pay rise of any head of a British university. The Complete University Guide confirms he got a £64,000 pay rise, which boosted his annual pay packet to £350,000. That's more, by the way, that's more than twice the salary of the Prime Minister, OK? So I said £400,000, but that's because it didn't end there. After that, an amazing raft of expenses that Mr. Shellard decided to spend, okay? If you click on YouTube and put in Mr. Shellard's name, you'll see him, like, dancing around, high-fiving, admiring crowds who are around him, and it's just unbelievable. He calls himself Professor Shellard, okay? And he led a mass flash mob while lip-syncing to Bonnie Tyler's 1984 hit, Holding Out for a Hero, to raise some issue about de Montfort University, OK? Now, that in itself, it was for a charity to raise money. It raised £5,000, but it cost £22,000 to put on, OK? But that sort of money, a loss of £17,000 on a charitable venture, was nothing. The university figures, which have been revealed, show that in 2016-17, so that's 1 year, think of a football season, Mr. Shellard, Professor Shellard, as he calls himself, spent £57,000 on business travel, which included £37,790 on flights. The Vice Chancellor flew economy or business, depending on the airline and destination, but he also spent £15,422 on hotels when he got to wherever he was going, and £4,160 on rail fares. Okay? And the records show that his business card bills included lunches and dinners from New York, New Orleans, Seville, Stockholm, and Shanghai. Okay? In addition to all of that, Professor Shellard, through the Remuneration Committee, of which he will have had some influence on, I assume, had a few perks, like, for instance, a rent-free two-floor flat in a Georgian house on the university campus, a car and driver made available to him if he requested it, and he shared this flat with his husband, John Walker, a man aged 47, who, you know, funny, was appointed lecturer on a new diagnostic radiography course at the same university. I'm not saying for a moment that there's anything dodgy about that, but it's nice, isn't it, if you and your husband can get a job working in the same environment and together, okay? Mr. Shellard, or Professor Shellard, he prefers to call himself, was an academic at Sheffield University before he went to the Leicester one. And, you know, this just makes me gasp. It makes me gasp because if it's only the 67th best university in this country, why do you pay the guy who runs it nearly 400 grand, including his perks? Where's that money coming from? It's coming from the taxpayer. Other people will say, oh, no. These universities generate all their own money, you know, through overseas students and all that. Well, I'm sorry, but if that's the case, bringing in overseas students just to pay the guy who's run the university £400,000 is in itself, in my view, a very dodgy principle, OK? So I'm telling you all, this has got to end, because education should be a situation, and it should be not an industry, but a vocation in which we seek all the time to help young people to get on in life. But that guy's having a laugh. That guy is spending so much money, living the life of Riley, flying around the world. Like to know how much time he actually spends, on working at the university. And I have to say, I am appalled. Who's the current education secretary? I can't remember, because Mrs. May has lost so many cabinet ministers and junior ministers and all that. So I'm not even sure who it is. Is it that guy Roy? Is his name Roy? I mean, his surname. Surname Roy? Could be. But anyway, whoever it is, I would like to issue a demonstrative statement now. Education secretary, whoever you are, I want you to have a look at that situation. He's not there anymore, by the way. Just to make this absolutely clear, he has now left. And one can only say, well done for that. But I can tell you that this is in no way an isolated case. All the universities in this country pay their vice chancellors huge amounts of money. Many of them are very average academic institutions. And it's just a scandal. And while I'm on this, by the way, about people getting paid lots of money in situations that shouldn't pay lots of money, charities as well are on the same thing, you know. We all give money to charities, but I'm delighted to say that a report, which I've only just come across, says that fewer people are giving money to charities as the voluntary sector continues to struggle with a loss of public trust. And that public trust is because, just like these university people, the people who run charities, they build glass palaces to run their organisations from, and they are organisations, they're not charities anymore. They have these huge glass palace offices, vastly expensive to run. They pay their senior people huge amounts of money. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds, just like the old professor here from De Montfort University. And at the end of the day, that money, which should go to helping people who are the benefactors of the charity, are losing out. If you don't think I'm right, let me tell you this. I used to be a very big donator to one particular charity, Sight Savers. I felt so sorry for little kids in Africa whose eyes were, you know, permanently scarred by crustaceans on their eyelids, and I wanted to do as much as I possibly could to try and help. When I tried a personal dialogue with the chief executive, and I'm almost certain it's not the chief executive now, this was a few years back, but I have a copy of the email, I was told that the chief executive doesn't in any way communicate one-to-one on their donors, even though I was a big donor, and I'd have to go through other channels. And all I wanted to do was get a hold of the chief executive and say, look, I'm a communicator, that's my job. I think I can help you with a communication policy to make more people aware of these poor kids in Africa. No, I was told not interested in you talking to the chief executive, who was a woman at the time. I don't know who it is now. And that drives me mad. I now give my money to a charity called the Main Chance Sanctuary, M-A-N-E, Chance Sanctuary. It's in Surrey, near Guildford. It's run by my great friend Jenny Seagrove, the actress, and it's for displaced and distressed horses, and it's a wonderful, wonderful institution. Just got a 50 grand grant from the National Lottery, but I'm a regular patron donator to that because it's a one-on-one. I know where the money's going. I know what happens to it. I know how the horses benefit, and a pittance, percentage-wise, goes in administration. Jenny takes nothing out of it, and she's only got two or three paid people at very reasonable rates to try and run that charity. Folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Right, okay, folks. Now then, good to have you back because there's so many subjects here that I've got to avail you of. Now, there has been some fantastic football activity in the last week or so, which you'll all be aware of. Even those of you who are not particularly football fans will have been absolutely enthralled that in successive nights, Liverpool and Tottenham Hotspur, that's real north and south, isn't it? Merseyside and North London. Their teams got through way against the odds. Both 3-0 down at one stage during their ties. Liverpool 3-0 down to Barcelona when they took the field at Anfield and overcame it and won 4-3. Tottenham Hotspur went to Ajax of Amsterdam. Magnificent stadium, by the way. Been there several times. They were 1-0 down when they got there and 3-0 down halfway through the game, right? And still came back, scored three goals, all away goals, so they counted double and got through as well. So it's a Liverpool versus Tottenham Hotspur Champions League final in Madrid, not at the Bernabeu, but at Atletico Madrid's new stadium later on this month. And that will be something to behold. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is not because I'm necessarily bigging up football, but I get really, really fed up sometimes about the way that people look down their noses at football fans, okay? Now, these football fans who went off to, in those two games, Barcelona and Amsterdam, and will be travelling to Atletico Madrid. Both teams will, you know, have hordes of fans going there. Lots of them won't even have tickets, but they'll go because they want to be where the greatest night of their club's lives had happened. Not Liverpool's case necessarily. Liverpool have won the Champions League five times before. Tottenham have not, although they have won a European trophy. I think it was in 63 they won the European Cup, Winners' Cup. And I think they got to the semi-final of what was then the European Cup the year after they won the league double in this country. However, people sneer at football. People say, oh, football is the working man's game. Well, yes and no. It used to be, but there's some very wealthy people now involved in football and some very wealthy supporters, and these are the people who support the game. But the reason I'm telling you all this is because I'm delighted to be able to tell you all that one of the games that sneers down its nose at football is rugby. You know, rugby are always telling us rugby is a game for gentlemen, football is a game for louts. And they'd like to sort of compare, you know, the activity of a very young Wayne Rooney, you know, with a gentleman rugby player, you know, like Will Carling or something like that, you know. Well, I don't get all this, and I'm delighted to be able to tell you about a report which I've come across from the Rugby Football Union about its own supporters. and not only its own supporters, but the people who support clubs from the executive boxes, even people who can be described laughingly as ambassadors for their clubs. So get this, the Rugby Football Union has introduced a code of conduct for its council and privileged members following a number of complaints about their behaviour during a recent England match at Twickenham, okay? It's understood the RFU president, Chris Kelly, was forced to remind council members at their meeting last month of their roles as ambassadors, particularly on match day. Now, you know where this is going, don't you? These guys who think they're God's gift to rugby and who have, made a great fuss over the years of having their seats displaced because the people who are the good guys in rugby want to keep improving Twickenham Stadium, one of the best in the world, national monument in this country to a great sport and all that, you know. And occasionally, when they've been remodelling one area of the stadium or they've been, you know, expanding it, the suits, as I will call them, have been asked to move for one particular game to another section of the stadium. But it's a longer walk from the restaurant where they get free grub and drink before the game. So these guys have kicked up against it, OK? So these guys, you know, you'd say, well, you know, they're the stalwarts of the game, the senior men, they set the standards. No, they don't. Mr. Kelly, I've just told you about, he's the, who is he? Chris Kelly, RFU president, has urged his colleagues to reflect on the high turnover of staff in the council services team at Twickenham, all of whom are understood to be female. Right, I will read between the lines for you there, okay? These young girls come in and do a job on match days, and you see them at every sporting event. I was at the Aintree Grand National recently, and we were looked after on our table by two young girls from Liverpool who were at school, but who were earning, you know, a nice bit of dosh on Saturday. I don't know how much, maybe, I don't know, £40 or £50, I hope, you know, by running around, serving drinks, serving food and all that. Lovely girls. And they'd be doing it so they could earn some money to go and buy some clothes or, you know, buy some books for their studies or something like that. And you should be treated with the greatest of respect. These young ladies must be treated with respect because, you know, they are hardworking and they want to get on in life. But what this reads between the lines, urged his colleagues to reflect on the high turnover of staff in the council services team at Twickenham, all of whom are understood to be female. It means what he's saying is, right, and I'm not naming any individual names, so this is an overall generalisation, some of those people got leery with young girls, with young ladies, with those who were serving them. That's an obvious conclusion if they're getting a high turnover of staff. No young lady is going to attend a sporting event and work there, you know, hoping to earn some money, putting in a good day's work, if she's going to be shown lack of respect and, frankly, worse than that, from a bunch of middle-aged and ageing blokes who think it's funny, you know, which is obviously what's happened here, to take the mickey and worse, OK? It is believed, I'm reading from the same report, the RFU has received a number of complaints from members of staff about the behaviour of their officials and guests. Particularly, right, get this one, kids, and, you know, I know you're going to say those in glass houses should not throw stones, but get this, their guests, particularly involving excess alcohol consumed during England matches. The absence of a clear code of conduct, however, made it difficult to instigate a fit-for-purpose disciplinary process. So these guys, right, this is what happens. Mostly men. They will have had some guests who might have been their wives or women or something, but mostly men are going to these hospitality lounges on match day, executive boxes, call them what you will, getting tanked up, right, getting bladderated, and then being less than respectful to the staff, many of whom are young girls, okay? And I think that is absolutely scandalous. Now, what I can tell you is this report comes after another report from another august sporting body. And the august sporting body I'm talking about is the MCC, Marylebone Cricket Club, OK? who have announced that they're ready to introduce a similar code of conduct after allegations, and that's all they were, that a woman was physically assaulted in the pavilion at Lourdes and another member faced, horribly, anti-Semitic abuse by a guest, okay? Now, what I'm saying is that wherever you find excess drink, money, put all that together, executive boxes, hospitality lounges, you will get a smattering of poor behaviour. But there should be people there all the time, stewards. There should be people there who are trained in how to regulate behaviour, who must not let this happen. To let a load of ignorant oafs into a room who don't know how to behave themselves, let themselves tank themselves up, stuff their mouths with food, and then be less than polite to the staff who are serving them is an absolute disgrace. I've never done it, and I never will, okay? Getting back to the rugby, a senior rugby football union council source says there have been a number of concerns expressed about the behaviour of council members, privileged members and their guests on match day. Council members are ambassadors for the game, and it is important that our behaviour reflects this. All day drinking and free bars are all very well, but standards need to be upheld. The RF, that's a quote from the spokesman. The RFU subsequently refused to deny there had been complaints. And again, a spokesman said, the code of conduct is underpinned by the RFU core values of teamwork, respect, enjoyment, discipline and sportsmanship. It provides a framework to advise appropriate standards and behaviour, as well as an open and transparent process for dealing with any breaches of code. Now, can I just say this, folks? I've been in plenty of hospitality boxes at plenty of football grounds around the world and hospitality lounges, okay? What we do at football is that you normally would get there, I would say. In fact, funny enough, lucky enough to have been at the Spurs new ground in the wake of them getting to the Champions League final. That was pretty sensational. And what a ground that is, okay? But in football, A, you can't drink within sight of the playing surface. So if you're in a box and there's a window, you can't drink because you're within sight of the playing surface. Also, they usually open those lounges 2.5 hours before kickoff. It's usually, if kickoff's 3 o'clock, I think it's 12:30, right? Now, I understand that the rugby drinking hours are longer. Not only that, but at rugby at Twickenham, and this is something that's developed because we always assumed that fans of rugby were civilised and disciplined, okay, they can actually, as I understand it, and I haven't been to a rugby match at Twickenham for a lot of years, take their drinks to their seats as they watch the game. Now, that is unheard of in football. So what I'm saying is, no matter how much people drink in the hospitality areas at a football ground, it all stops at 3 o'clock when the game starts. You can do it again between sort of 3:45 and, if it's a 3 o'clock kickoff, and 4:05. Then it stops again and doesn't start again until 5 o'clock when the game's over. Now, that's 2 hours of non-drinking throughout the afternoon. I think what happens at rugby matches, and I'm happy to be corrected, is that there is no stopping of the drinking. Now, on one of the occasions I did go to Twickenham, right, I was in a hospitality tent at the Stoop, which I think is the little small ground next to Twickenham, and I was being entertained, and it was a cold day, and England were playing Scotland. And as I went to go towards my seat, so I was leaving the tent at the Stoop, there was a guy standing there with a tray full of miniature drinks, i.e. whiskey, gin, vodka. And I'm talking about dozens of them. And I said, oh, that's nice. He said, oh, we'll keep you warm outside. I said, oh, can I have one of those? And I picked up a miniature whiskey. He said, take a few. It'll keep you warm till half time. So I took 4. Seriously. I thought, yeah, well, why not? And all the way through the first half, I was sipping whiskey out of these miniatures. It was very nice. And I hasten to add, I was very well behaved. But the problem is, not everybody's got the self-discipline that I've got. And it's obvious from this report, an official report from the Rugby Football Union, right, that some people who enjoy that sort of hospitality don't know how to behave themselves. So I say, physician, heal thyself, to the whole of the Rugby Football Union organisation and the game of rugby itself, before you start sneering and looking down your nose at anybody else, OK? And just to finish on a rugby note, by the way, I was delighted that you will have seen a few days ago, maybe a week ago, that Danny Cipriani, was voted the Rugby Player of the Year by his peers. His peers being, of course, the other rugby players. And I'd never understood why. I don't know a lot about rugby. I don't know as much about rugby as I know about football. And I'm not an expert on football by any stretch of the imagination compared to my colleagues in Fleet Street who are, you know, the top number one writers. But Cipriani, to me, has always been a flair player. And he's always been a fantastic character. And do you know what? I think that boy has been discriminated against. And do you know why? I think it's because he attracts so much women. He's always had fantastically glamorous girlfriends. Kelly Brook, actresses, models, all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And do you know what? In a competitive sport like rugby, I don't think people like him for that. They don't like him being successful with the opposite sex. Now, there is a conundrum here. Because I don't think that Danny Cipriani is very good looking. Now, as I'm heterosexual, it's perhaps not, perhaps I'm not the best expert and judge of whether a man's good looking or not looking, because I don't fancy them. But he's got, like, to me, looks like somebody's hit him full in the face with a pan, a frying pan. He's got about a flattened face, you know what I mean? But he's been very successful with him over the years. He's obviously got some great commercial deals, because, you know, he earns a few bob, about 400 grand a year, I was told. And that will be because of, you know, he seemed to be an attractive boy. But apparently, always having a problem trying to get into the England team because Eddie Jones, the England manager, who's Australian, isn't he? Or is he a Kiwi? No, he's Australian, Eddie Jones, says that he's looked at some aspects of Cipriani's game and is not sure that he's up to standard. Well, the Rugby World Cup's coming up. I'd like to see Cipriani there because I'm not a great judge of rugby football talent, but I'm a great judge of personalities and characters. And in my view, Cipriani brings something to the game. David Beckham had the same effect on the England team. You all know Beckham, brilliant man, great ambassador, made him captain because he was easily the most famous English footballer of his day, married to Victoria, posh spice, and Victoria Beckham, of course, you know, with her fashion line now and all that. And I thought he was a great man to lead England football. I would like Danny Cipriani to have the same sort of role in rugby, because at a World Cup, you need not just great players, you need great characters, you need people who are icons. And I think Danny Cipriani is an icon. You know, they can't all be like big, tough guys, Lawrence Dallaglio and all that. Fine man, Lawrence, you know. I'd done a couple of jobs with him. Sat and dined with him at sporting events and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, brute force. And that's what you need in rugby. But I think you also need charisma to change the game and the attitude of the game and the image of the game. You know, rugby's not all about a man having a broken nose that's been broken four times. It should be a bit better than that. I think Danny Cipriani is the man who could change the image of rugby. What do I know? Well, you make your own mind up, because you have been listening to me, the Porkmeister, Mike Parry, on Life on Planet Porky. More to come soon. I will admit, for the first time ever, actually, that I didn't actually go to university. I went to Trent Polytechnic, okay? And that has since been named the University of the Trent. So I always claim that it was the University of the Trent when I was there, but it wasn't. It was Trent Polytechnic. But I feel that as it's my alma mater, I now must treat it with the respect it deserves, with its new title, which is, of course, University of the Trent, named after the river on which it's based, the River Trent, which, of course, was the river that Robin Hood walked across and jousted with Little John before he established his band of merry men in Sherwood Forest, which, of course, is there. There is a conundrum here, because I don't think that Danny Cipriani is very good looking. Now, as I'm heterosexual, it's perhaps not, perhaps I'm not the best expert and judge of whether a man's good looking or not looking, because I don't fancy them. But he's got, like, to me, looks like somebody's hit him full in the face with a pan, a frying pan. He's got about a flattened face, you know what I mean? So let a load of ignorant oafs into a room who don't know how to behave themselves, let themselves tank themselves up, stuff their mouths with food, and then be less than polite to the staff who are serving them is an absolute disgrace. I've never done it, and I never will.